that Jim and Tony can be with us on this day, and they're going to provide some special music now, and maybe Jim has something to say.
Thank you. It's good to be back up.
In the 10th chapter of Genesis, we are at this juncture in the study of this book of beginnings. You have a diagram of Genesis on the screen, which gives you an idea of the movement of the stories in this book. As God is directing Moses to record these various stories, we've seen the creation story. We've seen the story surrounding the fall and its consequences. The story of the flood. The story of Babel. But there's something that comes in here that we ought not to lose sight of, which began at 3:15 of Genesis. And it's like a little spring. Like the spring of water, the small stream that begins up in Minnesota. And it moves further south. It picks up an increasing volume of water. And it flows in through the Gulf of Mexico to the mighty Mississippi. And this is the way, the truth, with regard to the Messiah is in the Old Testament. It picks up with a little trickle. Genesis 3:15. And increases in volume as we work our way. The scripture is bringing us down through thousands of years and through by different people, and we would like an extra chapter here and there, but we don't get it because God is bringing our attention right on down through these individuals from Noah, mentioning Ham and Japheth, but concentrating on one son, Shem, and then taking us from Shem quickly across ground to Abram, and then we'll come on down through the sons, to the other patriarchs, to one, the tribe of Judah, and so unfolds the reign of the Old Testament. We have him then in chapter 10, not just some record which is impersonal, it's insignificant, but it's very important. Let me give you some reasons for this table of nations in chapter 10. This table of nations. And as you read, so-and-so begat so-and-so, and the sons of Ham, the sons of Japheth, and the sons of Shem. Let's consider some reasons for this. The first thing we have to take into consideration when we walk into a chapter like 10, or when we come to a section like chapter 11 in verse 10, these are the generations of Shem, and so on. When we come to that, we must remember that God wants us to have, and he's given to us, the only inspired account of the origin of the nations. So for you genealogy buffs, I don't know how well you can do from the nations as listed in 10 down to your own family today, but you've got quite a gap in there, but this will show us how the nations have been arranged and have been sorted out and how they pushed out after the Tower of Babel. Now, we studied 11, 1 through 9 last week, for those of you who weren't here. Chapter 11, 1 through 9, precedes the division of these nations, their geographical movements. For they go out and geographically spread over the earth because of the confusion of languages. But God wants us to have an inspired account of the origin of the nations. What does it say to us? God is sovereign over all the nations. He has control the movement, the migration, the flow of vast numbers of people from one land to another, the movements of the sons of Japheth to the west, and Ham to the south, and Shem to the east. And God has been sovereignly in control of all of this movement, back and forth. This is all within his sovereign plan. The second thing we have to bring into consideration here is that the human race is seen as having descended from one family. One family. Genesis, or Acts 17:26, made of one blood all nations of men for to dwell on all the face of the earth. Here in chapter 10 is an exclamation point after the statement, solidarity. Solidarity of the human race. The fall of Adam. The total depravity of mankind. And all of it is seen as one group of human beings, all, as it were, in the same boat. And they literally came out of the same boat. So here we are. A sovereign account of the origin of the nations. Also a commentary on the solidarity of the human race. We're all implicated in the fall of Adam. And thirdly, there is a definite benefit that this had for the audience, that the writer was responsible for. Who was the writer and who was the audience? Moses was the writer, and for whom was he especially responsible? Israel. You know when Moses wrote this? Sometime in Israel's wanderings, a nation that was being formed out from among the nations as a people with a constitution and an objective to go to the promised land, there to face the Canaanites, there to take what God had promised. What did God do in leading Moses to write this history? It was to show, one, to the Israelites, the origin of the Canaanites. They needed to know something about the inhabitants of the land to which they were going. What was the background to the curse on the Canaanites? Why was God commanding them to go into Canaan and destroy the Canaanites? What had led up to this? Who were the Canaanites? What were their roots? To show Israel that this campaign was a part of a larger picture. To give them their strategy, the meaning for their strategy. So that is one significance for Israel. To give them the biblical and moral justification for God's war against the Canaanites. But it did this also. For the Israelites, it gave them their roots. Their roots. Where could they trace their roots? How could they? To Shem. Messianic prophecy is seen as beginning in Genesis 3:15, and they see it unfold as God works sovereignly to bring the line down through Abram, to Isaac, to Jacob, whose name was changed to Israel, through the tribe of Judah, preparing a part of the total tapestry of messianic prophecy to lay that before Israel. So all this is involved. Now, let's get down to work. We've got three sons of Noah and their descendants mentioned. Now, as we go through this, and some parts I'll slow down, but I'll try to move along as carefully as possible. It's important for us to see how these various nations became divided, subdivided. I want to get this laid out for us here. I don't know if I can get it all on the screen without confusing you. Here we go. Something like that. I want us to see now how the nations are going to be geographically dispersed. We're going to begin as Moses begins, 10:1. Now these are the generations of the sons of Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And under them were sons born after the flood. Now the sons of Japheth. He's going to mention seven sons of Japheth. They are Gomer, Magog, Madai, Yavan, Tubal, Meshech, and Tyrus. Now let's try to put these together. What nations came from, what roots do we have spread among these sons of Japheth and their sons? Well, when we come to Gomer, we're talking about a people who dwelt around the Caspian Sea, who moved northward. Why don't I just take this out and leave that on, and then I might even can write these in. We have, in the case of Gomer, the Germanic tribes, Teutons, the Celts, the Kurds, Scythians, the Sumerians, not the Assyrians or the Syrians, but the Sumerians. They lived in an area north of the Black Sea. So this is the area into which they moved. You're familiar with Magog, Magog, these terms from Ezekiel 38. Magog, the Black Sea, and the Slavic tribes descended from this son of Japheth. Madai, the Medes, those who would dominate the Near Eastern world during the times of Israel's disbursement from the land. The Medes around the Caspian Sea, out in this area to the east. Yavan, and Yavan, Greeks and Romans, the Ionian Greeks, as they moved north and then came down to the peninsula and settled in this little peninsula we know as Greece, here next to the Aegean Sea. Meshech, or Tubal, rather. Tubal settling here in ancient eastern Anatolia. This would be in the area of modern-day Turkey, as well as north. Now, some of these names apparently have been picked up in some Russian cities, and these people migrated and moved to the north. That's where we find Meshech, or Muscovy, which is a former name of Russia, was carried to the north and given to that vast land to the north. So we have the roots of the Russian people. And then number seven, we have Tyrus. And Tyrus is perhaps the the patriarch of all of the Etruscans, these people who moved north, who moved west, and then came down into the peninsula of Italy and dwelt there. So the Etruscans. Now, two of these sons of Japheth have their sons mentioned. Well, we go down to the next generation. First of all, we have Gomer with three of his sons mentioned. Ashkenaz, Riphath, or Riphath, and Togarmah. Now, Ashkenaz becomes the progenitor, the ancestor of the Scythians, Germans. As a matter of fact, the German Jews today are referred to as the Ashkenazi, even today. So Ashkenaz is the patriarch of all the Teutonic tribes, Scythians, Germans. Riphath, the Celtic tribes, moving out to Asia Minor, the Celts moving out over into Europe, Eastern Europe, Western Europe. Probably most of us would be identified with the descendants of Japheth through Gomer, through Riphath, because these people became the Celts. The Romans looked upon them as the barbarians. The Greek called them the Barbar, because they sounded like they were saying Barbar to the Greeks. But they gave the Romans fits because they were always pushing against the Romans from the north. And these Celts had a way of intimidating their opposition and living rather wide open lives. They had a way of fighting in battle by fighting stripped naked and putting lime on their hair, and it would stand up, and here they would come charging, and there was some kind of a premium on decapitating the enemy. This gave them some kind of special points and in battle. And so here were the Celts. By the way, we're talking about our ancestors. You like to think about your roots for a while. Well, these are our ancestors, the Celts. And they ran all over Europe and eventually moved and pushed westward. And so these, with a mixture of some others, of course, give us some of our roots. Then we have Togarmah. Togarmah, the one from whom the Kurds descended. The Kurds, these people who still live up in the northwestern part of Iran. The Iranians, the Persians, have still not been able to handle the Kurds. The Kurds live there in the mountains, a fiercely independent people. Also the Armenians from Togarmah. Then we have four sons who are listed here from Javan, or Yavan. Elisha, from whom have descended the Sicilians and those who occupy the island of Sardinia. We have Tarshish, which is a name used in the ancient world for Spain, the Western Mediterranean, the Spaniards. Kittim. Kittim is the father of the Cypriots, those who came dwell on the island of Cyprus. And Dodanim, who from descended those who occupied the Isle of Rhodes. So here are the sons of Japheth and some of his grandsons. In verses 6 through 20, we have four sons of Ham mentioned: Cush, Mitzrayim, Put, and Canaan. Let's take them in order. First of all, Cush. From him we'll see descendant of those Ethiopians, the Kassites, that is those who lived in the east of Assyria, out in this direction. We have some of his sons mentioned. We have one Seba. We're talking about Arabians here. Havilah, Sabtah, Rahmah. Now, two sons. We go down to a third generation here for Rahmah, and we have Sheba and Dedan mentioned. Apparently, these were well-known people, sons. Now, some of these nations are mentioned, and in other cases, people. So we've got a mixture through these table of nations. Here are two, Sheba and Dedan, from Arabia. These all occupied the western part of Arabia, this area out here bordering on the Red Sea, that area which is rather oil-rich at this present time, even over here to Kuwait, which is on the end of the Persian Gulf. So they were many of these were wealthy in the ancient world. You'll see this when we come down to some of the descendants of Canaan. Then we have Mitzrayim, and here from him descend the Egyptians. Ludim, Anamim, Lehabim, the Libyans, North Africa, the Naphtuhim, the Pathrusim, Upper Egypt, the Kassalim, the Philistines, who gave their name to Palestine, by the way, then the Kaphtorim, the inhabitants of Crete, and then Canaan. Now, nothing is given of Put's children, but we move right to Canaan, and look at all of the different children or sons of Canaan who are mentioned. Can you see why? Because God here is working through Moses to sketch for Israel the roots of the enemy, the possessors of the land at that time. The Canaanites, Sidon, Heth, and from Heth, this is a very important son of Canaan. Descendant, we have the Hittites, a very important people. Some recent discoveries have been made about the enormous vigor and the actual territory covered by the Hittite Empire. They move westward, and it's quite possible that the Orientals descended from the from Heth and from through the Hittites, the Mongoloid peoples, and therefore the American Indians through this son of Canaan. Jebusite, those inhabitants around Jerusalem, the Amorite, the Girgashite, the Hivite, the Arkite, those who lived in North Phoenicia, around Syria, the Sinite, possibly Lebanon. Some even suggest that here we have the progenitor of all of the Chinese families, groups, the Arvadite, the Zimmerite, and the Hamathite, who lived in the Lebanon area. So here we have all of the sons of Ham, and even grandsons. And we have those inserted in this section, one man who was quite notorious. We need to stop and just linger with him for a moment. And we're talking about a man by the name of Nimrod, verse 8. And Cush begot Nimrod. He began to be a mighty one in the earth. Now, the statements that are made about Nimrod in themselves are neutral, because it says several things about him. It says that he began to be a mighty one, he was a mighty hunter before the Lord. And the statement can be taken either way. He could have been a notorious hunter, he could have been, we would say, a hero, or he could have been a villain. But it seems to me, in light of what his name means, and his name means let us rebel, and his association with the kingdom of Babel, and what became of Babel, that this is apparently what happened. Nimrod was well known, that's the meaning of the phrase before the Lord, just means well known, it doesn't mean that he was walking necessarily with God, and he was a hunter of what? Some suggest that he was just a great wild game hunter, sort of a Teddy Roosevelt of his day, I guess. And that animals were was quite a threat in the ancient world. Coming off the ark, the animals multiplied rapidly, more rapidly than man, and it was a serious problem. Some suggest that he was just a great outdoorsman and a great big game hunter. Bagged his elephants and his lions and his tigers and so on. Well, I may include that, but I think he was more than that. I think that he's a hunter of men. I think he's a tyrant. I think he's a bloody tyrant. That's what I think Nimrod was. That's why I believe these facts are mentioned here. He is an ancient hero, but a villainous hero. He was the first man in history to found a world empire. Now, what is the nature of that world empire? We studied it last week. So he was well known for his building exploits. He must have, talked about charisma, Nimrod must have really had it. And he was able to gather people around him whose language had not been diversified. He was able to gather them around him, and he formed up this kingdom, and he even carried it on further, even after the division of the people, and developed an empire up around in Nineveh. So he went so far as to Nineveh to expand his exploits. But his kingdom was Babel. He was the one who attempted the first world dictatorship, though certainly limited in scope, but God saw it, and God handled it. So there is Nimrod, one of the first leaders of internationalism. Let's go quickly across country, and let's pick up Shem, the third son, verses 21 through 32. We have five sons of Shem mentioned. Elam, from whom descended the Elamites, Asher, the Assyrians, Arphaxad, very important because we're going to key on him, pick up him, and go down the line to his son, grandson. We'll come back to that in a moment. 4, Lud, from whom ascended the Lydians of Western Asia Minor, who dwelt in what we know as Western Turkey, ancient land of Lydia. And 5, Aram. Aram, or the Arameans, the Syrians, who dwelt in that land to the north and to the east of Palestine. Now we have 4 sons of Aram mentioned: Uz, Hul, Gether, and Mash. Now these all dwelt somewhere, best as we can tell, somewhere around northern Arabia, around Damascus, north of Edom, all up and down what is today northern Saudi Arabia, out in the desert area, in that vicinity. But we need to come back up to Arphaxad, the 3rd son of Shem mentioned. For it is through Arphaxad that we have a descendant, Shelah, and then Eber. And let's look at Eber for just a minute. Let's even look at his name. Looks like this in the Hebrew. Pronounced E-B-E-R, Eber. And it's suggested by some, and there seems to be some good reason for it, that what we have here is the root of the word Hebrew. And it means those who've come from beyond. So it could very well be that Eber, the name here, is the root of the name Hebrew. And when you get into the Old Testament, there are 3 terms that you ought to really keep distinct. We don't keep them quite that distinct in modern vocabulary, but they are so in the Bible. We have Hebrew, we have Israelite, and we have Jew. Let me make a distinction between these 3 words. The Hebrew was anyone who was a descendant, racially, of Eber. So now that technically is going to then pick up a lot more people than just the Jew. Well, we're going to see down through the line, this would pick up many of your Arabs, descended down through Ishmael. So, here is the Hebrew, though, the descendant of all those of Eber, racially. Then the Israelite were descendants of Jacob. So this has a national usage. All descendants of Yaakov, Jacob. And then the word Jew is referring to any the inhabitants of Judah. Inhabitants of Judah, geography, religion being the particular emphasis in that designation. All right, so we have Eber, but now we need to take a step forward to Peleg and Joktan. Now in verse 16, something special is said about Peleg. Well, let's take chapter 10 first of all. Before 10 is the special statement about him. 10:25, Eber, to Eber were born 2 sons. The name of the one was Peleg, for in his days was the earth divided, and his brother's name was Joktan. Now, what is this division of the earth in the days of Peleg? Jared, Hadaram, Uzal, Dikla, Obal, Abimael, Sheba. Sheba was known for great wealth. It was a seaport. We're familiar. You're familiar with the queen of Sheba, who journeyed to the west to visit Solomon and see of his wisdom. It was a seaport place on the Persian Gulf from which went great supplies of gold and precious stones. Ophir was the seaport city, rather, in this area, a rich source of gold. Havilah and Jobab. Now, you'll notice that attention is obviously put on Shem and his descendants. For we go further down with the descendants of Shem than we do with either Japheth or Ham. For really, Japheth and Ham are set aside very quickly, and we come down to Shem, for we come back to that in chapter 11 in verse 10. So if you'll look over there, you've seen that we've already covered much of that material in the closing part of chapter 11. For attention is now focused on the descendants of Shem. Why? Because of the messianic factor that is stressed by Moses. And this is the emphasis in the rest of Genesis. Who? The descendants of Shem. We've set Japheth aside. We've set Ham aside. They're only incidental to the main story thread. Also, Eber is the most important descendant of Shem. Why? Because from whom descends ultimately Abram? Now we need to very quickly put a few touches to summarize everything about these nations. What is God doing in this chapter? What does God want to see Israel? What does he want Israel to learn from this experience of all the list of the table of nations? I think he wants to very clearly reveal the line of the Messiah. He wants to show to Israel that Messiah has come through Shem, comes through Abram, comes through Jacob, comes through Judah. He wants to show them the line of the Messiah. He wants to show them how faithfully guarded the line of the Messiah. Don't think that couldn't have given them some courage and strength in the midst of their own context of the desert and the wilderness experience. God will faithfully guard the line of the Messiah. You are his special people. He will see to it that his promises to you will come to pass. There's also, I think, a purpose here for Israel to reinforce their destiny as a nation, to let them see that God has a purpose sketched for them in his sovereignty. Here is a sovereign God among the nations of the world who has a special destiny for Israel. And that destiny is so clear even before us today. That one people who have kept their identity through thousands of years, all kinds of disbursement, all kinds of conflict, and yet God has maintained the identity of the Jew. So here is the problem, or rather here are the purposes. Now there is a problem associated with chapter 11, and I think it would probably be a very difficult time to go into it. I'm only going to touch on it. And the problem is that of the genealogy of chapter 10 and 11. Is it a strict chronology? For you who aren't interested in this, if you want to put your mind in neutral, go ahead, but I wish you wouldn't. Is there a problem here? Do we have a strict chronology? Now, Usher, Archbishop Usher, presumed that we did. That's why he could put creation at 4004. I don't know, did he have the day and the time and so forth? But he had it set at 4004. Was he right in assuming that we have a strict chronology? That the years could be measured down from creation down to the flood, from the flood down to the Tower of Babel, from the Tower of Babel down to Abraham, and just by taking each name sequentially, you could get the total number of years? The answer is no, you cannot take chapter 10 and 11 with strict chronological interpretation. Now, you're going to have to take my word for it to a certain extent. I've got about 8 reasons, and it would bore you to tears if I went through all of it. It really would. That doesn't necessarily bore me. I find it kind of interesting. But I can give you just 1 or 2 statements to help you with this. If we have strict chronology here, then why did not Moses total up the number of years in chapter 11? He certainly meticulously did this back in 5. But he doesn't do it here. 2, he has left out the name of Canaan. He's left out the name of Canaan, who is included in the Luke's reference. This is not Canaan of the son of Ham, by the way. This is another Canaan. But he left out the name and years of Canaan. It does not appear. Genesis 5 and Genesis 11 are perfectly symmetrical in form. If I had the time, I could show you how he lists 10 in 5, and then you have 10 names in chapter 11. And there is an interesting chronology. There seems to have been a very definite teaching purpose, not so much chronology, but a teaching purpose involved in these tables. Well, I'm not going to go into that any further. I've lost some of you already. If you doubt me, I'll be glad to talk it over with you. Some of you, that's your cup of tea, and I'll be glad to work that out, and we can have some private discussion. But it's not strict chronology. However, I want to put a caution flag. I want to put 2 caution flags here. On the one hand, though it's not strict chronology, and you cannot measure 4004 B.C. is creation. Yet I want to put a caution mark down on the other end. Neither can you get the hundreds of thousands of years that some feel they need to accommodate uniformitarian geology. And they say that man is millions of years old. And so what they do is try to jimmy around with these genealogies and say, here, we can tuck this all in. Look, even when you recognize the fact that there are some gaps in these genealogical tables, even recognizing that, you're only going to come up with a variable of a few thousand years. Not 100,000, not that kind of thing. So we put two caution flags here. Just remember that. Now let's very quickly move across country because I want to get to Abram. I want to get to Abram and say something about him. I want to only give background to this man because we're going to be on him now for a while, the life of Abraham. One of the, if not the most outstanding Old Testament personality. Now we have him picked up for the first time, verse 26 of chapter 11. Terah lived 70 years, begot Abram, Nahor, and Haran. And he is taking us down to Abram, his wife, mentioning her because of some future in significance with her and Abram and the lack of children. You see, it mentions this fact when it says in verse 30, but Sarai was barren and she had no child. And Moses has put the statement in, a little editorial comment, in anticipation of a crisis that's going to come with regard to a promise that's going to be given to Abram. Terah took Abram, his son, and Lot, and the son of Haran, and his son's son, Sarai, his daughter-in-law, and so on. And they all went from Ur of the Chaldeans to go into the land of Canaan, and they came unto Haran. Now what we're going to do tonight and next week, what time we have left tonight, is that I want us to consider the call of Abram. Tonight I want us to just concentrate on the fact that it was a call of grace. I want you to think about the call of Abram for a minute. Look at it. Now the Lord had said unto Abram, get thee out of thy country. Right, we're going to stop there. We're not going to go any further. But get thee out of thy country. What country? Well, he's called him out of two places, actually, out of Ur and out of Haran. Where is the Ur of the Chaldeans and where is Haran? Ur of the Chaldeans is located at this point on the map, right to the north of the Persian Gulf, in the southern part of Mesopotamia. What was the significance of this call of Abram? What was the Ur of the Chaldeans like? A city which I guess if you went there today, you wouldn't be impressed. You wouldn't be impressed. You would wonder, well, if I had to live here, I'd be glad for a call too. I'd be glad to get over somewhere else. Well, we've got to go back a long time. We've got to go through time, thousands of years back to what Ur of the Chaldees was like in Abram's day. Ur of the Chaldees was a strategic city in what was the revival of the Neo-Sumerian civilization. The Sumerian, and I'm not talking about Sumerian, spelled this way, S-U-M-E-R-I-N, is the oldest civilization, at least on record. They've given us writing. That's why they appear so important in our history books. They give us some writing, and they had a vigorous civilization. I think it's divided into three phases, ancient and classical and then Neo-Sumerian civilization. Ur of the Chaldees flourished as a city in what is known as the Neo-Sumerian civilization. It's located 160 miles north of the Persian Gulf, 220 miles southeast of, well, what is modern-day Baghdad. This is all Iraq. In case you're flying in that direction, you'd like to locate it in the next week or two. This is all located in Iraq. Southern Mesopotamia, or what roughly is in the Bible is called Shinar, was the area of the ancient Sumerians. Who were they? What was their civilization like? What kind of city, what kind of culture existed in the days of Abram? Well, it was a very wealthy, a very advanced culture. The city of Ur was a very prosperous city. It was a seaport city. Excavation, archaeology has done a lot for us here. We can even get a layout of the ancient city of Ur. Now, the city is, or the river of Euphrates has moved somewhat since ancient days, but this is roughly the way the city, the Ur of the Chaldees, looked. Here you have on the outside, you had a canal that ran around the city. Over here to the western part of the city, you had the Euphrates River. Here you had a canal, ran this way. You had very narrow, winding streets. Here you had a harbor in this part of the city. A canal that comes in off the Euphrates into the city and connects with what was a north harbor. Connected like that. And you have a temple area, which was the strategic part or the center of it. And they've even, archaeologists have uncovered what are the remains of an ancient ziggurat, a temple tower here. And this was the focal point of the whole city. But this was a very vigorous, a very wealthy society. But what did the Sumerians look like? Who were they? How wealthy were they? How advanced was their civilization? Well, we've got a little bit of help. We would like more information, but we do have some things to help us. Let me take probably the most popular treatment of this subject, and one that's readily available to you if you have this set, Everyday Life in Bible Times by the National Geographic Society. And here we have around pages 44, 45, and 46, the artist's reproduction of what might have been scenes in that day and time, the days of ancient Sumeria and the Ur of Chaldees, as it could very well have been in the days of Abram. Picture here of a class, boys, taking lessons on learning how to make those difficult symbols in that wet piece of clay with a little stylus in their hand, and writing out all of the little letters, the little signs that would make up a letter, rather, in writing in ancient Sumerian. So there they are in a classroom, see. Abram could very well have been a boy like one of these boys, sitting in that classroom, learning the difficult task of writing, not just like sitting down and learning your ABCs, I might add. And we have some pictures which show us the activity of archaeologists in this city of Ur, the most famous of which, Sir Leonard Woolley, around 1922, 24, 25, excavated the ancient city, the Ur of the Chaldeans, uncovered some interesting things. Shows him here personally working on a particular, looks like an idol or a little, some kind of an art object that he's discovered in the ground. But here is a picture. You can't see it well. If you'd like to look at it afterward, I'll lay it down front. But here we have a picture of what is called the death pits at biblical Ur of the Chaldees. Startle the world with their 4,005-year-old cache of splendidly adorned courtiers, apparently buried alive to join fallen royalty in the nether world. Now, they had funerals in that day that just wouldn't quit. In one chamber, less than 27 feet square, Leonard Woolley unearthed 74 skeletons, women with headdresses of carnelian and lapis lazuli, silver and gold, chariots drawn by oxen or by asses, the drivers in the cars. One woman, perhaps late for her own funeral, left her silver hair ribbon still coiled in a pocket. While musicians played, Woolley surmised, the doomed drained cups of potion and composed themselves for death. Others came, slew the beast, and filled the pit. Now, there are some interesting other topics discussed with regard to ancient Sumeria. Here's a picture of some of the artifacts that have been discovered. beautiful works of art. Craftsmanship was excellent. And we cannot even begin to appreciate, it's hard to begin to appreciate, the advanced state of their civilization, their wealth, and the vigor of their culture. I wanted to read a few other incidents recorded here. I'm going to reserve that till next week, but I do want to pick up something from Volume 1 of Will Durant's series on the story of civilization. This volume, Our Oriental Heritage, and we have some interesting descriptions, or, well, here's an interesting description of what did the Sumerian look like. I don't know, what did Abram look like? That's not my main point. That's really, I guess, maybe a point of trivia. But he does have some excellent descriptive paragraphs of the Sumerian culture. Something about their appearance, something about their religion and morality. What am I leading up to? You know what I'm trying to do? I want you to see that when God said to Abram, get out of this country, and when the New Testament tells us that he left the gods of his fathers, that was a magnificent demonstration of faith. Do we begin to realize what Abram left? What he had, he pulled up and left everything. Oh, not only did he leave the evil, he left comfort and conveniences and went to a place. Listen, God didn't give him all the details on Canaan beforehand. No. No, he didn't say, now listen, it's going to be all like this. No. He said, I want you to go to a land. Now, the closer he got, the more information he gave him. Just like God gives us guidance. I'll show you that. But I want you to appreciate what Abram experienced and now what an act of faith it was. And when he left the gods of his fathers, what God was, that is grace, electing grace. By the way, did God have to select Abram? Was he some shining example over there in Ur of the Chaldees? I'm always amused by my friends who have an adversity to election. And they think that when election is taught, you're talking about, oh, somehow we've got to do something to earn God's acceptance. Let me tell you something. Name me one thing that Abram did to deserve God coming to Abram. I don't find anything in the text. As a matter of fact, he was a worshiper of false gods just like his father and grandfather. The moon god. The worship of the moon god at the temple with its sacrifices and incense and its priests and priestesses and all of that. And here is God's electing grace coming right down in the middle of it. And he appears to Abram. How did he? Well, that's an interesting question. How did he know it? Well, we've run flat out of time. I'm just going to stop at that point. We're past the point of saturation. But listen, that Abram is a magnificent example of faith in what he left. And I want to give you this preview of coming attractions. God never asks us to give up something that he doesn't compensate for in a greater way. Everything he left. Everything. What is Ur of the Chaldees today? A pile of rubble. Who would have known of Abram if he hadn't listened to God? He would have gone down with that civilization and would have been just another name, unknown, faceless and nameless. But look, he listened to God, he obeyed, and he made his mark. Well, let's see what we can learn. Let's pray. Lord, dismiss us now with a desire to see what is for us here in the life of Abram. Though separated by thousands of years, yet, Lord, here is a very practical way to study faith and grace. Here is a very practical way to see how faith behaves, living day by day and following your guidance. Teach us those things in Christ's name. Amen.